I'm Alana Roche.
And I'm Dr. Lauren Costine. And welcome to The Consciousness Salon.
The Consciousness Salon is a conversation where I, community activist Alana, meets with psychologist Dr. Lauren to explore current and historical issues in order to disrupt current paradigms and offer restorative tools and practices.
We will be discussing issues ranging from gender parity, misogyny, shadow work, microaggressions, looking at our internalized conscious or unconscious racism. And at the end of the day, how all of this affects how we feel about ourselves and others, and so much more.
Welcome back to the Consciousness Salon. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Alana. How are you?
You know, I can't complain. Life is good. It's been a good week.
Oh, I'm so glad.
Yeah. A lot of great things are happening. I'm really happy. I'm really grateful. And guess what? You know, this morning I shared with you the good news.
Yes, we have some good news.
We got our first sponsor, everybody.
Yay. It's really
victory.
Exciting. I know. It was like, made us both so happy.
Yeah. It's what a great feeling to wake up in the morning and have that be your first notification, your first message for the day.
Yeah, so, you know,
we're kind of like riding on the coattails of that excitement.
For sure, and it was interesting because, you know, it just sort of, we were like, oh, okay, you can have sponsors. And so we created sort of the space in it inside of Anchor FM. And then suddenly, you know, someone popped up with interest. It's like, because you don't know how it's going to work. We're still, this is still a learning curve for us, even in kind of month 8, right? Because we really started our, you know, initial planning in January.
Right, even though we launched in May.
Right, yeah. Well, it took months to get that kind of really...
Yeah, us understanding, right? Understanding what that all looks like and then calling it in. Saying, okay.
Calling it in.
It's set up. We're ready. Come on, universe. Bring it in. We know that the content we're producing is necessary and it's missing.
Very missing. Yeah, exactly. And I think also it was really, I loved the process that we had together because we were, you know, we wanted to get this going. There was a sense of urgency, but we also knew that we had to honor the process and that we also did that at the same time, kind of holding the tension of the two, which
is
really kind of what happens a lot in life in any sort of production.
Seriously.
Even though you're like, okay, let's just record. Like, it's no big deal. Like, you know, right? That's all you got to do, right? Well, no. Okay.
Let's really think about this. Let's create some continuity. Let's make sure we're intentional. What direction are we heading in? Because the thing about you and I is that we can totally get off subject.
So true.
So we have to be really careful. That's what we have
to go like on that limb.
On that tangent. Circle back and then go on another.
It's so fun.
And that's...
We love our conversations.
Yes. And you know what? Because of how we communicate, great episode ideas are birthed from it.
So, yeah. Absolutely.
So that's beautiful. We just can't do it in this... on this platform.
Right. So we do have a very organized show for you today.
We do.
That we're both on that note really excited about.
Yes. I mean, we're always excited about our episodes
and
topics.
For sure. Oh my gosh. I don't mean it like one is above another, but we were just saying that.
Yeah, we're actually gonna continue on with the internalized
phobia track.
I like that, Lauren. Right. And so today we're actually gonna talk about internalized lesbian phobia. And I'm going to have Lauren share a little bit about what that is and define that for us to get us started.
Okay, so I know we've done our other podcast around internalized homophobia when we really analyzed Rocket Man. And then we looked at internalized biphobia when we had our first guest, Ashley Shine. And so for our listeners there, you've gotten some idea of what the internalization of these phobias means. So, and just to give a little context, I know I've defined lesbian phobia before.
You've defined lesbian phobia, right. I'm sure, in a previous episode. But
we're just going to jump into it again.
Yep. Repetition.
Right.
Like you always
repetition,
say.
Because it's actually not a term that's really out there enough, but it's, you know, been a part of my teaching, you know, for 11 years now. I actually came up with this concept in 2008 when I was working on a bunch of different classes around lesbian identity and really looking into how do we develop as you know, lesbians, how is our psychosexual development occur, and so on and so forth. And I realized that, you know, one of the main differences that we have with our gay brothers is that we also deal with misogyny. So we're dealing with homophobia and the internalization of homophobic messages. But as cisgender women, we're also dealing with misogyny and then the internalization of misogynistic messages that we've been hearing since little girls, whether you know it or not, especially like, and whatever generation you're from, if you're from baby boomers or Generation X, like, you know, you can just watch some of the shows that are coming out today around that time period. You can see just how sexist and misogynistic.
Yeah, that's so funny because I was just sharing about Mad Men.
Right, about seeing the world that we've come from. It's gotten a lot better. There's a lot more important policing happening and awareness and so on, consciousness raising around this. But, like, I grew up in a, you know, really misogynistic
era
in the 70s. So we internalize this. And then, of course, the other important piece, if you are a, you know, lesbian, queer woman of color, then you're dealing with the added piece of racism, right? So we call these, like, double, triple threats, right? So when you're a woman that loves women, you know, you're going to internalize homophobic messages. You're going to internalize misogynic messages. If you're also a person of color, then you're going to internalize the racist messages. Those go deep into our unconscious. They go because they're really intolerable to hold. Plus, you may not know your sexual orientation for a while. It may take a while, you know, to kind of come to terms with that, whatever, for so many.
There's no formula.
Right. There's no formula. There's so many different stories around that. So These are getting deposited into the shadow anyway, out of your awareness, and they inform how you feel about yourself. So when you've got these like double oppressions, double threats, triple threats, you know, it's that much more work to love yourself, to feel valuable, to feel worthy, to feel good, to feel liberated internally, you know. So why do we want to look at this? Well, it's so helpful, A, to first know that this even exists because it's, you know, this conversation's not happening enough.
Oh, yeah, not at all. I mean, just this, the piece where we continue to repeat around the internalization.
Exactly.
Yeah, really just putting a spotlight on how we internalize these types of phobias.
Yeah, you know, and when, you know, there's...
And misogyny and other...
Right, misogyny and, you know, but when we don't know that we've actually done this, that this has actually happened to us.
Yeah,
right?
A lot of folks are unconscious to it.
Right, then you don't even realize that it's informing...
Your decision-making, how you operate in the world.
How you feel about yourself. And then, of course, we see this in all kinds of symptoms. Now, symptoms is complex. So the symptoms that we may have are complex. There's physiological components, there's genetic, there's environmental, and then there's all these, you know, internalized message piece. But taking all of it into account, knowing that maybe you're prone to depression or prone to some sort of addictions, depending on your family genetics, knowing that, you know, you have other things that you're, you know, dealing with, but also knowing that you've internalized these messages, that they're inside of you, and bringing them into awareness is, as we always say, is the first step.
That's so just a huge knowing, healing piece there.
Right, huge. And then the second healing piece around this that I've always said is so important is realizing that this is society's fault, not ours. Because a lot of us will say, well, I don't feel worthy or good enough or lovable or, whatever it is, the kind of feelings that you have about yourself, a lot of shame, things like that, and saying, well, it's something that I've done. Like, a lot of us will do that. We'll internalize. We have a huge inner critic that can be very subtle and very clever and very repetitious. So it's like in there saying all these things.
And that's a really common human element or aspect of the human condition.
Very.
Yeah. I mean, it happens in various scenarios.
Right. And then, you know, but not realizing that you have downloaded all these messages that society has created thousands of years ago. It's passed from generation to generation, era to era, you know, downloaded in different ways, passed on to you through your family systems, through whatever town you grew up in, through your school systems, through your peers, through your religion, if you were raised in that, through all of these, you know, pop culture. Like, I mean, it just goes on and on and on, right? So all of this is in there. And then it's
influencing.
Influencing so much, right? And you don't, and like I've said, okay, you don't know it. And what's really important is to realize it's the messages that have been, you've been told about yourself. It's not you. And it's, what's helpful about this is to keep doing that. Like, okay, these messages that I may have internalized about myself are not actually about me at all. They're about this really dysfunctional system that we've all been raised in.
Part of the indoctrination.
Yeah.
That's so hard though, Lauren.
Yeah.
You know, that is a huge ask. It's a huge ask.
Which part's a huge ask?
Of ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, to first stop, listen to those voices, and have the self-compassion to disrupt it by stopping and looking at it and going, okay, wait. Just that moment.
So that takes a lot of inner work, right? And that takes seeking professional help when you can, and you know, finding very safe spaces, or one or two at least safe friends where you can share your most honest truth,
right?
And be vulnerable, and it's going to be a, you know, safe. Someone's not going to run out and try to fix you or try to change it. They can't tolerate whatever feelings you're having. Like, those are not safe spaces, right?
Because usually the next step around this awareness is having someone else hold, like, be a soundboard and say, hey, this actually isn't you at all. This is a false narrative.
Bingo.
Let's take a look at that and stop. And that is why you're suggesting reaching out for safe spaces and professional support and professional mental services. Like, it takes someone else outside of yourself most of the time
to teach you this,
to really address it.
Yeah.
And then from there you start to slowly build that resilience around going, okay, I've been here before. Those same voices are coming back.
They're telling me the same thing. Maybe around a different story, but it's the same methods.
And same energy around it. And okay, I'm going to start practicing the tools. You start utilizing those tools that were given. So this is really incredible. This is really a huge psychological piece that I think all people can benefit from. Not just folks from the LGBTQ community.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
I think everyone can really benefit from just understanding the messaging that we are internalizing.
Yeah, I mean, it's
on a human level.
There's like, you know, there's a classist message, right?
Right.
There's an ageist message.
Ageist, classist.
You know, there's an ability message. I mean, right. It goes on and on and on and on, right?
Right.
So, and I think what's really important for what we're talking about today, this is where LGBTQ plus affirmative psychotherapy, when it's really done well, actually addresses this.
Yes.
This is when this kind of professional actually brings it up for you in the room, doesn't wait for you to bring it up, actually educates you. We call it psychoeducational component in the room, and then explains exactly what I'm explaining, and then helps you start figuring out where it may be showing up for you and how you can bring that awareness to light so that then you can start working with it, healing it, and managing it.
Like, and this is what you do for a living.
Yes.
This is your profession.
Yes, this is a big part of what I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You were so passionate about it.
You know, it's partly because it literally saved my life.
Mm.
Like, you know, I did
That's
this.
That's powerful.
Yeah, and, you know, everything that I teach or talk about or do in a professional level, I've actually done myself.
So incredible.
Yeah, I don't, like...
You talk the talk, yeah. But you also walk the walk.
Yeah, because I feel like I can't really, you know, talk about this authentically unless I've actually also experienced it and worked on it myself, and then it comes from a whole different level when you're trying to do the consciousness raising with others. Yeah. Right,
and people see that, they feel that, they recognize that.
Yeah, people are intuitive, they're smart, they can sense it when they're in the room with you or if you're teaching them or what have you, you know. So that's a really important piece of this. And I think, you know, what are the symptoms? Well, like we were saying, your inner critic, relationship issues, your social anxiety. I think what's a really big one in our community is going to like large, you know, women's events, lesbian events, queer women events, and feeling a lot of social anxiety around it and not understanding why.
Yeah, and that's really common.
And then kind of reaching for alcohol.
Yes.
To deal with that. And we would call that all a symptom, because actually when you have a lot of internalized lesbian phobia, to be in a room with a lot of lesbians and queer women is understandably scary.
I'm so glad you're mentioning this. I'm so glad you're talking about this. I'm so glad you brought this up. Because I think a lot of queer women experience this and they don't really understand why. I think they associate it with, oh, well, I'm just an introvert or whatever. And I know I've experienced it as an extrovert.
Right, exactly. Or like you're comfortable in other spaces. So why am I so uncomfortable in this space? I think that's how I really noticed it. I was like, I don't feel this when I go to an environment that's not so activating for me and really kicking up my stuff. But when I go into this environment, I'm like dysregulated.
But I do wonder if that experience for me is along the lines of when I originally or initially found community, or that's a really good piece that I have to look at later.
No, I think you're bringing up something about me. But when you really, really work on this, you know, on all of your internalized phobia, traumas, things like that, you can start feeling liberated enough that you can go into any space, any women's space, and feel okay. But that's because you have really healed so much of yourself and you're not projecting.
Right.
Other, you know, like your own, you know, disowned feelings about yourself onto others. Mm. Or, and this is a whole other piece, but, you know, they're not potentially your mother that really triggers you, because we actually tend to project our mom stuff onto other women unconsciously. And if you had a judgmental, critical, neglectful, you know, overbearing, whatever kind of mother stuff you had, all of that can be like, oh my God, this room of women can really activate that. It's really fascinating.
Because it's reflective in the women in the room.
Yeah. And it's a vulnerable space to be putting yourself into, this space where you may be looking to meet somebody, or, you know, you're just not feeling, you know, you're just not, you haven't really worked on all of this stuff. So it just brings it up.
Sure. Yeah. No,
yeah, it's making sense. Okay.
Yeah. No, completely. I hear you. And thank you for kind of uplifting that and bringing it to the surface, because I think a lot of queer women and women who identify as lesbian have experienced that at one time or another.
Yeah.
It may not be like a consistent ongoing issue. Unlike, I think that might be an ongoing consistent issue for like the extreme introvert. But in general, I think we all kind of on some level experience that.
Right, of course.
So, and then, in varying degrees.
Right. So, or at certain times may feel it more than others, you know what I mean? Depending on where you are.
So, you know, I do, with that being said, now that we've really dove into the internalized experience of lesbian phobia, can you then attach it or at least connect it to if that's a reflection of, or if one of the symptoms is toxic shame versus healthy shame?
Yeah.
You've mentioned toxic shame versus healthy shame in previous episodes, but as you always say, repetition, repetition. So I know I would like to repeat that component, if you don't mind.
Yeah, no, I think that's really important because I think when we internalize, see, look, this is the reality, you know, the era we're living in now, I mean, just even the last 10 years, is so different than the thousands before that. You know, I mean, just the movement towards marriage equality, fighting for all of our rights, you know, fighting against all the stigma, has radically changed a lot of things for those of us in our community in certain parts of the country and certain parts of the world.
I mean, you say 10, I say 5.
You think it's 5? Okay.
I think it's,
maybe it has been 5.
You're probably right, but, you know, I'm being cynical right now.
Right, right. And you know, I just remember being, like, deeply in creating all of this work and curriculum and programs and stuff, and then starting to see the momentum and being like, whoa.
Oh,
got it. It's like, what? Like, you know, when I started working on all of this stuff with my various mentors and colleagues, you know, we were thinking 50 years from now. Like, there just didn't seem like this
was going to... You didn't imagine it would be implemented so quickly.
No.
Right.
No,
okay.
Really didn't. So the point is, you know, we're talking thousands of years of messages inside, you know, internalized and collectively and individualistically. And toxic shame is that feeling that you are unworthy to be alive. Mm. Like, you're not worthy of anything. And it's a really horrible, horrible feeling. It's just, and it can feel like it's at your core, right? If you go there. And one of the things is, it's so uncomfortable to touch, right? That most folks don't go there.
Ugh, that's so true.
And it's, I don't recommend going there on your own.
Right, be facilitated.
Without support. Yeah.
Right.
Because you want to have the support when it does hit you, right? So we've been told that we're an aberration. We've been told that, you know, our sexual orientation is sinful. Lots of folks who've been raised very religious grew up going, you know, I'm going to go to hell. You know, I mean, horrible, horrible, horrible messages. At the same time, we were mentioning this earlier, right? Thousands of years ago, it was classified through the morality of the church and other kind of ideological messaging with bestiality, pedophilia, and homosexuality were clumped together whenever these perversions were discussed. So as we got into the modern era, you know, homosexuality, same-sex love was still called a perversion, right? And that, along with these, you know, associated with these other horrible sexual behaviors, you know, it created tons of toxic shame around who we are. Does that make sense?
So yeah, I mean, I was just thinking about what an incredible wall that created for us to be seen, for our humanity to be seen.
Yeah, no, and it was not, yeah, it was
perversion,
like,
or demented, you know, that... There's just, yeah, it's unfortunate that
so
that was the categorization, you know, that's categorized in that group.
Oh my God. I mean, it's just been so, it was so damaging and has
so
been
damaging.
So,
that's exactly.
Yeah. And
how do you undo centuries of that?
So the good news is you can really undo this. And how is it different than healthy shame? Healthy shame, as I you know, I think we discussed before, is you do something that harms yourself or others, and then when you reflect on it, you feel bad about it, but you also know that it's true. Like, it was harmful to someone you care about, or it was harmful to yourself, and you want to really work on not doing that again, you know, and there can be some healthy shame in that. That toxic shame is owning something that's not yours, that's telling you you are
worthy to be alive.
Know, and I think from a visual example, for those of you who watch Lord of the Rings, Gollum is a really good example of like the shadow and of toxic shame. Like this, just even physically, you know, he's like this sort of shriveled up, physically like skinny, kind of very toxic, you know, little creature. It's kind of what it kind of can be inside of us, if that makes sense. And I think we're going to talk
That's about a really that. Great visual. Thank you for that. That'll definitely help me remember the difference now between toxic shame and healthy shame. Earlier, folks, I was telling Lauren, I'm like, I think I keep switching the definitions between these two words, right?
Right.
It's
right.
Not just jumping out at me. Now I have Gollum, the image of Gollum attached to toxic shame. I will not forget that now. So
it's helpful. And
that's
definitely
really helpful.
And watch that movie. I mean, that's a classic example of the shadow just and toxic shame, like eating someone alive.
Yeah. Right? That's great. Thank you so much for that. And by the way, everyone, Dr. Lauren actually coined the term lesbian phobia. And she mentions, and she, if you want to learn more about this amongst, you know, lesbian love addiction, etc., it is, please go and get her book, Lesbian Love Addiction, The Urge to Merge. And we will add that link to this episode as well for convenience. But yeah, she knows there's so much there.
Yeah, I get like a lot more into this.
Yeah, there's so much there. We're just, we're going to wrap up that piece for this episode. But if you want to learn more, please reach out or buy her book. You know where to find us. So let's learn a little, or let's share a little about the herstory, or I should say an aspect of herstory.
Yeah, I love what you've done here, Alana. So
oh, thanks.
You've done some beautiful research here.
So. Thank you. We do, you know, Dr. Lauren and I wanted to highlight some herstory, and it really focuses on the Daughters of Bilitis. And I'm not going to, you know, dive fully into its history. So I'm going to do some brief references. But just to start us off, you know, the Daughter of Bilitis. Oh, and one more thing. I also want to give a shout out to Lillian Faderman, who is an incredible lesbian historian. She has written so many books, and I just want to thank her for taking the time to really compile our history so I can benefit from it, everyone can benefit from it, and generations to come can continue to benefit from it. So thank you, Lillian, for that and your work. But Daughters of Bilitis, it was an organization created by two lesbians by the name of Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon. They were actually lovers for 3 years, and they decided to form the very first lesbian civil and political rights organization called the Daughters.
You mean, so at 3 years of their relationship, they decided to form it, right?
Because at 3 years.
Because they were married and lived together for
at the third year of them being together,
right?
But at this time, you know, they were together forever
for the rest of their life.
They lived happily ever after, so to speak. But yes, by the year three, they just noticed that they felt like they were the only lesbians in town. And I think there's a lot
isolated.
I think there's a lot of lesbian couples that feel that way. They just stay home, they live their life, and funny enough, you know, this was in the 50s, and they had these gay guy friends who essentially were like, there's other lesbians. We know them. Of course. Leave it to the gay boys to somehow find the other lesbians. And then, I don't know, I just think that's so hysterical because I see that happening today.
I know.
Still.
Right.
The lesbians can't find each other, but somehow the gay guys and the gay girls can find each other. Anyway, so here they are. They decided to create this organization, and it was actually, it started in San Francisco. And it's just good to know that, you know, this is history that started before Stonewall. I know that there's a lot of focus and emphasis on Stonewall, as there should be, but there was still movements happening in smaller scale prior to...
I mean, this is all really important
this
steps.
This is leading up
to the tipping point of Stonewall.
Exactly.
Yeah, really huge. A lot
right.
is going on.
I think we forget that there's been...
Yeah.
The smaller movements that happen prior.
Because the tipping point is the one that always gets the most attention.
Of course.
Yeah, because it's usually the revolution. It's the revolutionary piece. It's the big dramatic piece. But anyway, go back. So that's really
that's a really great point. I just, for terms of context, I want people to understand. This is the 50s.
And the 50s was such a scary time. Period.
Right. Because
McCarthyism.
Exactly. The witch hunts. I mean, this is right after World War II. So already government is essentially making it known that homosexualities are a threat to our security.
Right.
So they're like, they're out for us.
Why is it a threat to our security? There's a really interesting reason.
Do you want to share that?
Well, it was part of it was...
I'm just trying to be careful about how much I dive into this history.
Oh, no, I think it's so important that this was the beginning... This was the Cold War, right? So there was so much fear around the Soviet Union and the United States, and there was this huge Cold War going on, as we all know. And part of the fear was that... You know, homosexuality could be used as a bribing technique. I mean, so what we're going to be looking...
Yeah, they said, I think it's like bribing or blackmail.
Blackmail.
Yeah, some way to put us in a position where somehow we would be at a... It would weaken our position in terms of power, international power.
Right. So, and honestly, this is, you know... homophobia disguised into something else, because if you're involved,
should have laughed, but that's real.
Espionage, like if you have children, you're vulnerable, right? So it's like, whatever. The point is, there was all this externalized homophobia that was really influencing, you know, our community.
And the closeted element. For safety and for survival.
Very, like, putting food on your table, paying for the rent.
Like, so I need to keep my job so I can live my life and stay alive.
Right. And it goes back to, like, in the Daughters of Bilitis piece and was a lot of lesbians at this time were teachers.
Right.
Because you could get a job, a secure job, get your paycheck and all of that, and not have to marry a man, right? So it was one of those jobs that was out
financially
there.
Self-sufficient.
But because of this connection to pedophilia, the threat of being exposed if you were a teacher for being same-sex oriented was huge.
Of course.
Because
they would connect it immediately.
Right.
You're around
parents
children.
Would go in and say, get her out. She's a danger to my child.
And then that's your whole career.
Right. And when the reality is, they were amazing teachers. I mean, this
of course.
Is what's so horrific about it.
Right.
But this influence, it was very influential. And then we see the internalized piece, right, Alana?
Yeah, but before we jump to the internalized piece, I really also just want to highlight a really incredible woman, an African-American woman, who was also part of this organization, which, you know, I don't know. What I do know is that Black women and Black queer women in general, historically, aren't acknowledged. And they don't receive the attention or acknowledgement they deserve. And this woman,
go ahead. Or they're not allowed in the organizations.
Or they're not.
Right? They're not even invited. Like, we see so much segregation in our own research, right?
So yeah. I really want to emphasize that this organization specifically was open to that, and they all became friends. This woman's name is Cleo Glenn Bonner, and she ended up becoming the elected national president in 64.
So cool.
But they traveled together and did these conferences, and they, Del Martin and Phyllis Lyon, came to bat and support her when the world treated her like a second or third class citizen.
Right.
They confronted the racism in those days, wow, on top of all the other layers.
Yeah.
And so, and rightly so. I mean, this woman had so many titles. She really stepped into this role, took it head on in terms of the organization piece, the management of the organization. So I just want to give some love
for sure
to Cleo Glenn Bonner for what her contribution to this organization and to the movement as well.
Well, and it's so important that we keep telling these stories as well when we're talking about all of this, to keep saying, look, this is what really happened. You know, we had the trans woman in there, Beth Elliott. We've had they have their, you know, African-American president. Like, this is a very important part of the story of this organization and everything that we're talking about today. And this is the kind of stuff that can be left out when the stories are told by white people. Right? White,
it always gender, is.
White. Yeah, even
the
yeah.
blind spot, the lens is just not equipped to highlight
yeah,
these women who are so
point.
Deserving
yeah.
of acknowledgement. So that's kind of my commitment to this podcast as well, is that when we do this herstory, as much as I can, I'm going to seek out those women, those queer women of color, who are in our history, and that needs to continue to be reflected as we
Me
as
too.
We as we
I'm,
share.
I'm
no, absolutely. no, absolutely. I didn't want to get too far into the psychological component
no,
yet.
Yeah, good. Thank you.
But yeah, so Cleo Glenn Bonner, if you're curious to learn more about her, please Google her, or check her out. She's in quite a few LGBTQ history contexts, or, you know, books and
written about. Her contributions, all the things she did, is written.
It's
about.
Out there.
Yeah, it's out there.
It's out there. So yes. Yeah, so moving forward, their mission initially, this organization, was to support women who were afraid to come out, but eventually evolved into a mission to convince the heterosexual society at large that gays were not different from straight people, and in encouraging its members to assimilate as much as possible into the prevailing straight culture. That's a lot, right?
That's a big shadow piece there, right?
I mean, there's a lot there.
Wow.
But that is the piece in terms of the internalized lesbian phobia that we're talking about.
Yeah. Keep going. I love where you're going, so let's do it.
So, to elaborate on what that looks like, is at some point in the movement, they were following in suit or in line with Mattachine Society. And
what's Mattachine Society, real quick?
You talk about Mattachine
Society. Well,
Mattachine
Society was the first kind of group of gay men that got together, founded by Harry Hay in also the 1950s. They had a manifesto, they had a mission, and it was also similar kind of idea was to help understand that we actually have a community, that there's actually a whole bunch of us out there. Back then, did not know how to connect, right, and gather. So he brought that together. Also, he had done, this is really sidebar, but I'm going to say it. Harry Hay had done a lot of, he connected with the Native American tribes a lot. And he had learned from them this idea of culture, you know, that groups of people that gather together or are connected together actually have culture just unique into its own. And then he was able to start seeing that in the gay community, that the gay community actually had its own unique culture.
And this is in the 50s.
And this was a radical idea. That's what's really important, is this was a radical idea. It's like, we have our own culture. We have our own way of connecting with each other. We have our own way of looking at the world. We have our own way of expressing ourselves. We have our, you know, that kind of stuff. So
isn't that interesting? Right? That is kind of like their mission, their movement, their identity. And yet they decided to go, okay, getting the straight community to accept us seems like a far stretch.
I know.
To accepting us and our culture and what our identity is, that's just not going to happen.
Especially
not in this era.
Especially when you have any sort of gender expression that is outside
of the norm,
of the small heterosexist box.
Yes.
Of like, feminine wears skirts.
The binary.
And masculine wears, you know, coats and ties, right?
So they decided that the way they're going to move forward in this movement is to essentially assimilate.
Right.
And therefore, the Daughters of Bilitis was, you know, kind of followed in those footsteps. They were watching what they were doing, kind of, and said, okay, this seems to be the most logical approach at this time, since, you know, in the era of witch hunts and McCarthyism.
And so, you know, just to honor how complex it must have been and how scary, I mean, I know how, you know, I can feel like if I don't have a safety net, it can really create a lot of insecurity inside of myself. And I know a lot of, you know, people can suffer from that. But at the same time, you know, the internalized lesbian phobia was definitely informing these kind of decisions of like, well, assimilating, is the way to save us.
Yeah,
Of actually bringing our community together, making it stronger. And the thing that's really important is they were not looking at their inner worlds at this point. It was, you know, and for so many reasons, very externally focused, right? And so was the Mattachine Society, very externally focused. And we do know, as inner warriors ourselves, that this is not the easiest path or necessarily the most chosen path, but it is the most liberating path.
Yeah, at that time. And you talk about the external, but, you know, they were living in a time where everything was about the external.
Everything.
I mean, there wasn't a thing you could do that wasn't external focused. So they were just trying to survive within that paradigm. So,
but at the same time, we want to see that this was definitely, you know, the internalized lesbian phobia at that time was really affecting them. And this
assimilation.
See, I'm like,
now
I
started picking it up. But assimilation in this way, I mean, they were assimilating to the binary. Like, they were making butch women dress up and put dresses on and conform to the feminine presentation. They just feminine presenting.
So basically, and asking butch women to be in drag.
Basically. Right. And that's dehumanizing.
Very. And this is important. So the dehumanization.
Yes.
That a lot of the women had to endure during this time.
Yes.
Is going to, again, feed the internalized phobia oneself and the inner
critic. And the toxic shame.
And the toxic shame.
Exactly. That's the full circle.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's so true. And they didn't even realize because they were just trying to survive. Okay. So let's see. Where else did we want to go from this, Alana?
Well, you know, I just want to make sure that our listeners know that if any of this resonates for them, right, I would like to offer them some next steps. Right? I would like them to kind of just get a feeling for what you would recommend doing. I know we talked a little bit about this earlier in the episode in terms of, you know, reaching for professional help, etc. But there's definitely a lot. There's definitely a lot here, and I want to make sure that they know exactly what to do next.
Yeah. Okay. So I think really, you know, the first piece is recognizing that you may have symptoms from, you know, drinking too much or eating too much or not feeling good about yourself or, you know, having relationship issues or, you know, all of these kind of symptoms that we can have, you know, having some depression and anxiety and figuring out which part is actually physiological and which part is situational or coming from unresolved trauma and not looking at our toxic shame. So then it's really important to seek professional help or figure out some safe spaces where you can talk about this thing. You know, I wanted to give an example of what toxic shame can really look like as it is linked to lesbian phobia. So when I was working on creating some programs, I had to talk about my own lesbian identity and difficulty coming out and in front of a group of colleagues as we were creating curriculum. And I did it. It was very hard for me to do, but I did it. It was in the middle of doing my own work around my internalized lesbian phobia. And the next day, I'm walking around in my house, and I am cringing. I'm turning around, and I'm remembering exposing myself to this. It was a very safe space, by the way. There was no judgment. This was not like I was in a judgmental place. This was like as friendly as it and loving as it gets. And I was just turned over in this incredible cringe feeling of like, oh my God, I've been seen, this part of myself has been seen, and I'm going to be found unworthy. I'm going to be deemed unlovable and something to hate and disgusting. And I just had to sit with it. I'm telling you, Alana, it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. I can go back there today like it was yesterday. It was such a big deal. But the fact that I did that and then I was able to talk about it in my therapy and continue to look at it and keep talking about why this made me feel so awful about myself, it started to go away. It really is one of the hardest things I ever did and one of the most liberating things I ever did. So it is crucial if you are finding that you are not, you know there's more you need to be doing in your life for yourself on whatever level that is, that you start picking up this rock and looking under it. And it may be really hard at first, but I promise you it gets easier as long as you do it. You just do it and make sure you have the support behind you when you do it. And then looking at, you know, all the areas of why you would have lesbian phobia and then realizing it's not your fault. So that's really the call to action today, is like, find that growth mindset inside of yourself. Find that courage.
Find the courage.
And do this inner
work.
To
pick up, you know, to look underneath the rock, look at your shadow, look at it. Just ask. Be inquisitive.
Yeah, and like you said, you brought up that really important piece with self-compassion as much as you can. And then, you know, there's some great self-compassion exercises that we can put into the link as well that are very helpful.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Alana. I'm glad I could. You know, I
really hope our listeners can hear that story. And if it does resonate for them, feel inspired or, you know, find the courage to take the next step, right?
Yeah.
So, well, on that note, I think we can wrap up.
Yes, I think so.
What a great way to close out our episode.
Yes. Thank you.
Wow.
See you next time.
Yeah, thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us today and tuning in. And we will see you, or not see you, we will chat with you in our next episode.
Yes, we love you all, and thank you so much for being supportive and listening, and if you feel inspired, please leave a review on iTunes.
On Apple Podcasts.
Apple Podcasts.
Yes, if you feel inspired to subscribe and follow us on Apple Podcasts, we'd really appreciate it. And yes, so much more to come. Stay tuned. Bye, Lauren.
Bye, Alana.
The Consciousness Salon is owned, operated, and produced by Alana Roche and Dr. Lauren. Music is produced by DJ Roche and edited by Tyler Hood.
We would love to hear from you. There are a number of ways to contact us. My website is www.drlaurencostine.com. That is DrLaurenCostine. And I have a Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram page.
You can reach me at www.alanaroshay.com. That's AlanaRoshay. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter as well. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Lauren Costine and Alana Roche and their guests on the show. The content here should not be taken as medical advice. It is for informational purposes only, and because each person is so unique, please consult your healthcare professional for any medical or mental health questions. Thank you.